We welcome you again to the Mormon Channel, to this episode of Past Impressions, a program where we study the history of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and examine people, places, events, and issues associated with that history. I'm Brent Topp, Professor of Church History and Doctrine and Chairman of the Department at Brigham Young University. And with me today is our guest, Stephen Harper, Professor of Church History and Doctrine at BYU and one of the key researchers on the Joseph Smith Papers Project. We're glad to have you with us, Steve.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, Steve, today we want to talk about the period of time in the Prophet Joseph Smith's life, of that period from the first vision when he walks out of the grove that early spring morning in 1820 until he leaves the Hill Cumorah with the plates in hand and begins that divine translation process. Now, I know that you have talked about this period of time, and you call it the probation of the teenage seer, of a teenage seer. Now, why do you use the word probation, and how do you refer to this period as a probationary period for Joseph?
Well, there are several things going on there in those words that I've chosen. I think it was Terrell Givens at first, at least as far as I know, used the word probation to describe this period. And I've picked up on it. What he means there is that Joseph Smith is being tested in many ways and being trained and refined. And I think that this is the most significant insight that we might help listeners understand about this period, and it is that Joseph is not simply biding time. He's not simply waiting for 4 years until he can get the plates. You could read verse 53 of his history that way in the Pearl of Great Price, but to do so would be to miss what Joseph is saying there. And when we have all the historical documents that are available to us, it becomes quite clear that Joseph is on a year-by-year probation. I hate to cast Moroni as a probation officer. I don't want to give the wrong impression of what I'm trying to say. I'm not trying to suggest that Joseph is some sort of criminal and is being grilled here, but rather that a very generous and loving Heavenly Father is raising Joseph up to do a marvelous work, and that under Moroni's tutelage, Joseph has started early. He's going to have to grow into the role of translator and fully developed seer. And so with Moroni's very close and careful supervision, that's going to be a process. One that's very active and involved and has some ups and downs in it, not just Joseph being fully developed and able to accomplish his mission right from the very first awareness he has of it.
Now, you mention in there that if we had the full historical record body, we would have a different view of things and we would get a more expanded view of that one or two verses in the Joseph Smith history account. Well, what kind of historical records are available for that time period? And what glimpse do they give us that we wouldn't get ordinarily just from reading the account that's included in our Pearl of Great Price?
That's a great question. And I think listeners will be very interested in the answer. I think probably most people listening know about Joseph's history, Joseph Smith history, we call it. It's gigantic. It's written into what we sometimes call the manuscript history. And these are great big books in the church's archive. And what we have in the Pearl of Great Price is a real tiny slice out of that history that's been canonized for us. It's so important that it's become part of our scripture. The historical events that tell us about the first vision, the reception of the Holy Priesthood, the coming forth of the Book of Mormon, these are vital. These are key restoration events, and so it's become part of our scripture. But beside that account, there are several others, and these are far lesser known. And in fact, some of them are earlier. Joseph wrote an autobiography in 1832, and it takes up about 6 pages of his letter book. His earliest record-keeping endeavors begin there in the last part of 1832. He starts keeping a journal. He writes an autobiography. He starts compiling his letters. And that autobiography is rich and wonderful. Joseph, I think, felt a little self-conscious about it, as he did of his later efforts as well. You'll notice that he starts them out by apologizing for how poor they're going to sound, he says, because he never had a chance to go to school very much. And so there's not much punctuation in those 6 pages, some misplaced modifiers and the sorts of things we see in our students' papers at BYU.
Or even our faculty papers at times.
Yeah, yes, indeed. I make some of the same errors. But Joseph Smith has given us himself essentially a very early autobiography and then a draft of a later one, 1834, 35. And then the one that most people know comes from 1838 and into 1839.
You're listening to Past Impressions on the Mormon Channel. I'm Brent Topp, and with me is Steve Harper, professor of church history and doctrine at Brigham Young University. We are talking about the historical records that are available to us that help us to understand that probationary period of the Prophet Joseph's life, particularly from 1823 and 27. So, Steve, continue. Tell us some of the interesting things about those historical records.
Well, we were mentioning that Joseph made a few different autobiographies telling about these key events, and I want to get into those in some detail. But let me also mention that Oliver Cowdery wrote about this period of Joseph's life. Oliver served as the church's first historian and made some errors, but also added some detail in his account. And probably the next richest account beside Joseph's is his mother's memoir, which she wrote in the 1850s. And here again, wonderful, rich details, things that we don't have anywhere else that Lucy tells us. And when we put these together and then add things like Joseph Knight's autobiography and reminiscences, then we get a quite fleshed out picture of these years in Joseph's life. And when we do that, we're ready to read verse 53 in his canonized history in a much more informed way. Here, Joseph, speaking of his first visit to the hill, says that I made an attempt to take them out, meaning the plates, from their box, but was forbidden by the messenger, and was again informed that the time for bringing them forth had not yet arrived. And at that point, there's a comma, and we stop hearing Joseph paraphrase Moroni, and we start hearing Joseph make an interpretation or an editorial comment where he brings his readers up to speed. At the time of this writing, these events are in Joseph's rearview mirror. He now can see and understand them in a way that he couldn't understand them on that first day that he went to the hill. And so he provides us a little bit of context, brings us up to speed. So he says, neither would it. That is, neither would the time for receiving the plates arrive until 4 years from that time. Okay, so you understand there that Joseph is editorializing. He can see in retrospect that it took him 4 years, mm-hmm. and the time for receiving the plates wouldn't come until 4 years after that first visit to the hill.
So are you saying then that Moroni may not have told him right there on that very first visit that it was going to be 4 years, mm-hmm. or do you think he knew at that point that it—
When we put all the historical records together, it is crystal clear that Joseph does not know that it will be 4 years. And I'll tell you how that works out. Here in this verse, Joseph begins now paraphrasing Moroni again. But he told me that I should come to that place precisely in 1 year from that time, mm-hmm. and that he would there meet with me, and that I should continue to do so until the time should come for obtaining the plates.
So it was kind of open-ended at that point.
Indeed. Now, when you realize that, it makes the history quite a lot more dramatic and interesting. It's not a passive four-year period where Joseph's just got to put in time. It's a probation. Moroni gives him very strict instructions and tells him to meet him there in 1 year. And Joseph does come back every year and has to account to a messenger sent from the presence of God. And I see in this period Joseph more concerned and less of that native cheery temperament that he talks about in this 4 year window than I do on either side of it.
But you think he's just feeling a little spiritual stress then
enormous.
That he has to report every year.
Enormous pressure, as you might imagine. And so we wonder then about how these events unfold. If we look at the historical records closer, Joseph tells us in his earliest autobiography that he goes to the hill to retrieve the plates on that very first day after Moroni's visit, and he can't get the plates. And he says to no one in particular, why can I not obtain this record? And then he tells us that Moroni appears out of the blue and says, because you have not learned to keep the commandments of the Lord. So you begin to get an idea of what this accountability process is like and how stressful it might seem. We don't know all of the instructions Moroni gives to him, but they're quite detailed from what we can surmise and very strict. Moroni wants to see if Joseph can be trusted with this record. The whole Satan and all of his hosts are going to try to ruin the Book of Mormon project. Joseph cannot take it lightly. Moroni tries to instill in him how serious this is going to be, how difficult, how much opposition he's going to face. So Joseph cannot have the plates that first day. And Lucy adds an interesting insight, that is that Moroni tells Joseph he needs to wait not only until he's willing, but until he's able, as if he needs to grow some more. He needs to mature.
For the translation process, you
right.
mean? Okay.
And even just to take the records home, to have them in his charge. As you know, as soon as he gets them, there's all kinds of effort to get them from him. A group of treasure diggers, also Lucy Harris and others, his father-in-law, his wife's uncle, all these people try to in some way or other, get at the plates. And Joseph's going to have to face an enormous amount of pressure and opposition.
So it's the building of his strength, both spiritually, emotionally, and he is understanding the absolute solemnity of this role that has fallen on his shoulders.
That's right.
You're listening to Past Impressions on the Mormon Channel. We're speaking with Professor Steve Harper from the Department of Church History and Doctrine at Brigham Young University. Steve, you mentioned that Joseph had received very, very specific instructions, and this probationary period was to see how loyal, obedient, devoted, and pure he would be to be able to fulfill this divinely mandated mission. What did the historical record say specifically about those instructions, and that he's going to have to go back year to year to report on what we might call a personal priesthood interview? What is it that the Lord has specifically commanded him to do?
I like that way of thinking of it. I like to think of Moroni as Joseph's young man leader, his young man's president or advisor. And we begin on that night in September of 1823. Joseph's history tells us that Moroni quotes to him several passages of Scripture and paraphrases some. I won't get into those as much. Those are easy to read in Joseph's history, but you asked specifically about the instructions, the commandments. On the third appearance Moroni makes that night, he tells Joseph that he will be tempted to use the plates for wealth, and this he is explicitly forbidden to do. He cannot. Now, Moroni says that not only that night to Joseph, but he actually said it in the Book of Mormon. You might remember, I think it's at Mormon chapter 8, where Moroni blesses, blessed be he that shall bring this record to light, but don't have any idea that you can use the wealth embedded in these plates for making yourself rich. So Joseph's got to do battle with covetousness, not only the natural covetousness that's in human beings, but it's going to be a little more acute for him, or maybe a lot more acute, because of what Moroni called the indigent circumstances of his father's family. They've got a $100 mortgage payment to make, a cash payment at the end of every year, and they need to raise that money. And Joseph knows that a fair part of that burden is his. He has to help the family raise the money to pay the bills. And there may even be it's not clear, crystal clear from the historical records, but I interpret them to suggest that at times even Joseph Sr. doesn't fully understand yet in this process, not at the end of it, but during this process, he doesn't fully understand what the significance of the Book of Mormon project is. And he may put some pressure.
He knows there's some great work.
Right.
But
right. Please try as hard as you can to understand that we can see things in our rearview mirrors. We can see from historical distance. Joseph Smith has given us the history as it finished, but he was going through it, as were his parents. And the historical records show that they didn't understand everything about it as they go through it. Moroni talks them through it, or talks Joseph through it, and then he'll talk his family through it. Let me give you an example. Joseph goes to the hill the second time, 1824, September. He anticipates that he will come home with the plates. Beside the commandment to not use them for covetousness, he knows he has to keep them from anybody else's view. At some point, he's given a commandment to keep them in a locked box, but it's not clear whether he has that commandment in 1824 or not. But he does anticipate that he'll come home with them, and so do his parents. Joseph goes to the hill. He knows that he can't use the plates for wealth, and so he picks them up from the box. His mother tells us that he turns to take them, and then he's tempted. The temptation is, I know you can't use the plates for wealth, but there are some other artifacts in the box. Mm-hmm. You know, why not use those for personal gain? And what a predictable temptation. You can almost see Joseph having worked very hard for that year, saying, I will not relent to the temptation to use the plates for getting wealth. And so he steeled himself for that temptation. Then he's blindsided by the other one. And this is
even
common.
Just as a fleeting moment, just a fleeting thought.
Just a thought. And you can guess where that thought comes from. Mm-hmm. And Joseph decides to entertain it for a minute. So his mother tells us that he sets the plates down to then cover over the other things. Well, when he turned to get the plates, they're gone. And he's horrified, as you might guess. He knows very well that he accounts to an angel for these plates. And so he then does that very thing. He accounts to Moroni, who rebukes him sharply for setting the plates down and for thinking about using the Book of Mormon project at all to get wealthy or to provide anything material. And so Joseph goes home very much discouraged. Mm-hmm. And his mother is very anxious, and so also is his father. His mother tells us that he comes home and he's met by Joseph Sr. with, did you get them? Did you get them, Joseph? No, father, I did not get them. Well, I would have got them if I were in your place, his father says.
Yeah. You're listening to Past Impressions on the Mormon Channel. I'm Brent Topp, and we're visiting with Dr. Stephen Harper of Brigham Young University Department of Church History and Doctrine. Steve, you were telling us about that first time as Joseph comes back from the Hill Cumorah and doesn't have the plates in his possession and the reaction that he gets from his mom and dad. Why don't you build on that and tell us a little bit more about what happened in that 1824 evening?
His mother later called it the first failure. And that is, Joseph comes home without the plates. His father says, did you get them? No, I didn't get them. Well, I would have got them, his father says, if I were in your place.
That could have been a stinging rebuke in and of itself.
And Joseph replies to it according to his mother and says, father, you do not know what you say. The angel of the Lord would not let me. And so you can see both Joseph Jr. and Joseph Sr. growing in their understanding about what this stack of plates is. They've come out of a folk culture that believes in buried treasures and even guardian spirits. And they're probably both initially interpreting these events in that context. They're thinking about what these things mean based on the experiences they've already had or what they've been taught. Mm-hmm. They have to grow out of that. And I believe that part of the reason that it takes a while is that Moroni teaches Joseph Smith out of that. Mm. He brings well, there's an interesting dynamic going on. Joseph is not surprised by a message that there's a stack of buried gold in the nearby hillside. That's, you know, word of that is kind of in the air. And he and his father and other folks in the neighborhood, respectable folks, it's not nincompoops solely who are about this work, but these folks believe in that kind of thing. And so I don't think Moroni minds if Joseph initially receives that understanding in the terms he's familiar with. But I do believe that by the time Joseph gets the plates, he's got to have been reoriented. Mm-hmm. He's got to learn that this isn't a stack of buried gold for his material comfort. And it's not just a guardian spirit looking after a treasure buried by explorers or by Native Americans. This is the record of Christ's dealings with folks in the ancient Americas, and it was put there by this very angel while he was still immortal. So Joseph's got to come to that understanding, and he grows into it, and his father also grows into it over time. I hope listeners will allow Joseph, mm-hmm. senior and junior, to grow over time, just like we hope we can be allowed to grow in our understanding
and
development.
Well, just think in our own culture how many years it sometimes takes us to break down certain traditions or false notions.
Right.
It is not easy for any person to kind of be reoriented to spiritual things.
I agree. In fact, I'd go so far as to say that many of us still have those mm-hmm. things, and the Lord is kind to us. He's awfully patient in bringing us along. Well, that leads us to 1825, and our historical records are really silent on this year. We don't know exactly what happened because Joseph says essentially that he meets Moroni there every year for 4 years. We assume there's an 1825 meeting. We just don't have any details of it in our historical records. We do know that 1826 is a turning point. Joseph Knight tells us that that year, according to Joseph, Joseph Smith, tells Joseph Knight that year he received an ultimatum from the angel. You will get them 1 year from now, Moroni says to Joseph, or you will never have them.
Oh, man. What a strong admonition there.
Imagine the stress of that.
I felt the pressure the first year. Can you imagine at that point? Yeah.
Now, it's also in this window of time, 1825, 26, that Joseph has been south to the southern part of New York and the northeastern corner of Pennsylvania, and he's there on a treasure dig initially. He's been hired by a man named Josiah Stoll, and Stoll comes to find Joseph Smith not because he has a strong back. He could have found that sort of thing closer to home. He comes for Joseph Smith because Joseph has a reputation for being able to find lost objects, or as Joseph's mother puts it, discern things that could not be seen by the natural eye. Mm. And this gets us all the way back to where we began. You asked why I call this period the probation of a teenage seer. And we started talking about why we use the word probation. Now you can see why we use the word seer. Joseph is a seer. Mm-hmm. And I want to refer listeners to that wonderful definition in the 8th chapter of Mosiah about what a seer is. And we might say that Joseph was a lowercase s seer long before he was an uppercase s seer.
Interesting.
He's got this gift, and he comes to know it at some point. His mother knows it. His father knows it. And people 150 miles away, at least some of them know it. And Joseph's got to decide what he's going to do with this gift. It must be a terrible temptation to use it for all kinds of purposes, as well as some he could easily persuade himself were quite justified. Why not go and work for Josiah Stoll if he's going to pay me and help offset my family's mortgage and other things? Why not? And so he talks himself into that. His father goes, and we have good evidence that he and his father are engaged with Josiah Stoll and a whole bunch of other folks in a treasure dig.
How do you see Joseph different in 1827?
Yes, Joseph grows up in this period. he becomes much more understanding of what the Book of Mormon project is all about and what it will require of him. He's not perfect by the end of this period. He never claims to be perfect in his whole life, but I see him much more mature. He is now not only willing but able to shoulder that load, and it is an enormous load emotionally, physically, mentally, psychologically. It's an enormous load to be the person responsible for the Book of Mormon plates and the coming forth of the marvelous work. So Joseph, I think a key in his development is meeting and marrying Emma Hale. Hmm. She will be with him at the Hill in 1827 when he retrieves the plates. She will be a great strength to him, a believer in him. And I think that added a lot to his ability, his preparation.
Dr. Harper, thank you so much for helping guide us through what you call the probation of a teenage seer and to see how Joseph grew up spiritually, emotionally, and was prepared by Moroni and the Lord for that monumental task. Join us again for another program of Past Impressions on the Mormon Channel. I'm Brent Topp, your host, and look forward to having you join us again in the future. Thank you.